Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments I'll be shining the spotlight on Pope Pius XII. That's with Rabbi Eric Silver. And after that, on a different note, on the Fatima story. But first, as always, at this time of week, we join Benedict XVI in St. Peter's Square on the occasion of his weekly general audience with pilgrims from across the world. Emma McCarthy reports.
20,000 pilgrims and visitors packed an overcast St. Peter's Square Wednesday to hear Pope Benedict XVI's weekly catechesis.
Comincio con un appello.
Speaking in Italian at the end of the audience, the Pope launched an appeal to world leaders gathered in New York for the review conference on the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, asking them to overcome the constraints of history and patiently weave a political and economic plan for peace to help human development and the genuine aspirations of peoples. The Pope said the process towards a concerted and safe nuclear disarmament is closely connected with a full and prompt compliance with international commitments. Peace, in fact, he noted, rests on the trust and respect of obligations, and not only on the balance of power. Also on Wednesday, Pope Benedict XVI used his greeting to English-speaking pilgrims to launch a strong defense of marriage, which he described as an instrument of salvation, not only for married people, but for the whole of society. His comments came in greetings to a group of pilgrims from Jönköping, Sweden, where a conference on the family will take place later this month.
Like any truly worthwhile goal, it places demands upon us, it challenges us, it calls us to be prepared to sacrifice our own interests for the good of the other. It requires us to exercise tolerance and to offer forgiveness. It invites us to nurture and protect the gift of new life.
Pope Benedict went on to observe that those of us fortunate enough to be born into a stable family discover there the qualities of good citizenship. He encouraged all in our efforts to promote a proper understanding and appreciation of the incalculable good that marriage and family life offer to human society. Earlier in his main catechesis in Italian, the Holy Father had reflected on this weekend trip to Turin to venerate the Holy Shroud, which he said invites us to contemplate the face of Christ and to share in his saving work. But the main body of this week's lesson was a continuation of his reflections on the priestly ministry, and in particular the ministry of sanctification.
In the celebration of the sacraments, in particular the Eucharist and the sacrament of reconciliation, Christ's sanctifying work is constantly made present and effective.
Speaking in Italian, the Pope pondered whether an underestimation of the faithful exercise of this ministry has represented a weakening of the current action of Christ through the Church.
In the devout celebration of the sacraments, priests sanctify the faithful and are themselves sanctified and configured even more closely to Christ.
And my thanks there to Emma McCarthy. But time to move on in the broadcast and join our next guest. Stay tuned. Founded by a Jew by the name of Gary Krupp, the Pave the Way Foundation is dedicated to removing obstacles between religions by initiating gestures of goodwill, such as that of clearing the reputation of Pope Pius XII, the Roman pontiff who led the Catholic Church during the Second World War, and has been accused ever since by many in the media of alleged silence over the Holocaust. If you happen to have listened to our programmes over the past years, you'll have heard some of our interviews with Mr. Krupp, as well as with some of the people he's often put us in touch with. In a few moments, we'll be giving voice to the most recent of his suggested guests, a very welcome one. He's Rabbi Eric Silver, who was kind enough to sit down with me here in our studios. His story begins when he first got involved with the Pave the Way Foundation. It was January 2005.
I and a group that included 25 rabbis, under Gary Krupp's leadership, went to pay respect to His Holiness Pope John Paul II. John Paul II has always enjoyed the highest regard amongst Jews for his work in setting aside the prejudices of the past and working with Jews, being the first pope in 2,000 years to visit a synagogue, and so forth. And Gary Krupp realized that no one had ever said thank you for what he did. And so we went as a group of rabbis of different denominations from different countries to pay our respects to this man who was then in the twilight of his days and to express formally the thanks of the Jewish community for everything that he had done. We were his last private audience. When you shook hands with him, he had a grip of iron. And I will tell you, in my work, I have met with heads of state. I travel around the world. I have never, ever experienced a presence like his. It was true holiness in every sense of the word.
You mentioned in your work you travel a lot. Can you describe what your work is?
Well, I'm simply a rabbi. I've been involved with a group called the North American Board of Rabbis, and we've done some traveling around the world trying to build bridges of understanding, and somehow the paths of this organization intersected with Pave the Way. And that's how I got in touch with Gary Krupp. Then some years passed, and it was in September of 2008 that Gary phoned me and said, I'd like you to come to Rome. And I said, I'd love to come to Rome. A trip to Rome would always be welcome. When are we going to do this? And he says, rather immediately. We're going up there. And I said, Gary, are you aware that the Jewish High Holy Days commence in 2 weeks? I'm a little bit occupied. This is right before Rosh Hashanah. I can't do this. This is very important. We're going to be looking into things regarding the canonization of Pope Pius XII. And I said, very good. That's an internal affair. But if they're asking for opinions from Jews, put me down as a no. I would not favor this. I think that his wartime record is not one of which he should have been proud. And Gary says, well, that's why I'm calling you, because you're a scholar, you have an open mind, and I want you to examine the facts carefully and then see if you will be agreeable to changing your mind.
So what was your opinion?
My opinion was that Pope Pius was terribly guilty of the sin of silence at the very best, and perhaps even of some complicity at the very worst.
What did you base this idea on?
This is the sort of common knowledge that goes around through the Jewish community. I had read The Deputy when it first came out.
By
Rolf Hochhut. And Cornwell's Hitler's Pope and so forth. And I was not impressed.
So when did you change your mind? When you discovered that he had a crucial role in humanitarian relief?
Well, that's right. And remember, I have been involved in interfaith work for years. It's been a passion because I really believe that we work together for God's glory. And so I am able to see people of other faiths as equals. I was one of 25 rabbis at the first ever symposium of rabbis and cardinals that was held in New York. There was a theological discussion, and I was one of 12 rabbis selected with 12 imams in the U.S. at the first National Summit of Rabbis and Imams. So my interfaith credentials are well established. So Gary Krupp said, well, you know, concerning Pius XII, there are things you don't know, and I'd like to show you the evidence, and you have, and the reason I'm calling you is A, because you are an opponent, and B, because you have an open mind. I want you to go. I want you to see what we have. So I said, well, you know, you've just given me my Yom Kippur sermon. I don't know what it will be, but it's going to be there and the chips will fall where they may. I'll invite you to my synagogue. You can be there. And he said, fine. You come
where
to
is your
Rome,
synagogue?
In Cheshire, Connecticut. And he says, very well, I'll come to Connecticut for Yom Kippur and you will come to Rome for this symposium. So I did. My wife and I went to Rome. And we participated in the symposium, several grueling days of poring over documents, of looking at eyewitness testimony, of hearing eyewitness interviews, of meeting eyewitnesses. And at the end of the time, I said, there is nobody on this planet who did more to rescue the Jews of Europe than Pope Pius XII.
So you trashed your previous readings then?
Realize, first of all, the deputy, Rolf Hochhut, the author, was an East German communist who was under the guidance and the employ and direction of the KGB. Cornwell's book, Hitler's Pope, is a total fabrication. It is an outright blasphemous lie against, when I said unworthy deeds, there is no man more worthy than Pius XII to stand at the right hand of God. I truly believe that this man was one of the giants of the 20th century, one of my heroes.
That's pretty strong.
I could not be stronger, in my opinion, regarding Pius XII. And remember, I told you I was an opponent. I thought him unworthy.
So now when you dialogue with your fellow Jews, what do you tell them?
I try and tell them the truth.
And how do you do that? By telling them to read something? Or?
I tell them you can read things, to look at the evidence. I tell them about the origins of the deputy. I tell them about the obvious flaws in Cornwell's book, including the digitally doctored photograph on the cover. And then I point out that Cornwell has since repudiated almost everything that he wrote in there. And then we come to the very question of, well, why was Pius silent? And I say, well, was he really silent? Do you mean, did he not make a public denunciation of Hitler in the way that Roosevelt did? Roosevelt denounced Hitler in the most unequivocal terms. But of course, Roosevelt was in Washington, some 4,000 miles from the nearest German soldier. It was pretty safe for him to say anything he liked. Pius was a scant few meters from the nearest German soldiers, who had weapons aimed into his chambers. So you can say, oh, well then, so he was afraid for his life. Not in the slightest. I am absolutely convinced that Pius had not the slightest fear for his own life. He was afraid, however, that if he made any statement that would infuriate Hitler, that it would cause significant loss of life among innocent people. Jews would be rounded up. And we saw what happened when the Bishop of Utrecht in Holland spoke out against the roundup of the Jews. The persecutions accelerated, the roundups accelerated, the numbers of people that were rounded up increased. And I think we learned a lesson by that, that you didn't shame Hitler, you simply infuriated him. And you said, okay, more of this. We'll give you more of this.
New generations of Jews wouldn't even be aware of the existence of Pius XII. Would you say that's correct?
That's correct, because it was on Yom Kippur 2008 that was, quite by coincidence, the 50th anniversary of his death. And so it was on that day, sacred to us, that was 50 years to the day that God called him home. And I believe to a well-deserved reward.
So when you speak to your fellow Jews, what is the reaction in general?
Initially skepticism, and then I say, look, and I just run a few facts by them, and I said, I can merely scratch the surface here. If you want more, I'll give you more, but this is not even the tip of the iceberg. And they say, I never knew that. Why doesn't this information surface? Well, why doesn't it surface? Because the Soviet Union had a very good reason for wanting to discredit Pacelli. You know, he was anti-communist, and anything that they could do to smear the man's reputation so they could make him somehow complicit in the Holocaust, that would satisfy them, and that's why they did it. What a shameful thing for them, but, you know, I refuse to be a stooge of the Soviets. And I tell people, you know, when you follow this line of reasoning, you are allowing yourself to be made into a KGB stooge. I'm going to be spending my time over the next several years getting the truth out. I think Pius XII needs to be honored by Jews, as well as by Christians, for what he has done.
And my thanks there go to Rabbi Eric Silver for taking the time to share with us his opinion, and also to Gary Krupp of the Pave the Way Foundation for putting us in touch with him. Finally, on a totally different note, since Pope Benedict will be at the Marian Shrine of Fatima at this same time next week, I thought I'd bring you the Fatima story in a programme by the title of The Miracle of the Sun, written and presented by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett.
On the 13th of October, 1917, thousands of people gathered on a mountain in Portugal witnessed an event commonly known as the Miracle of the Sun. Paul Claudel called what happened at Fatima an explosion of the supernatural.
Today, Fatima is almost commonplace. Since what happened there was recognized by the Church as genuine, all the popes have referred to it.
But the extraordinary event of 1917 is not familiar to everyone. Here then is a presentation of what happened that day, using verbatim accounts from the witnesses themselves.
The impression received by over 100,000 witnesses was that the world was about to end. And at a predicted time and place, a phenomenon occurred which could not be explained by natural laws.
A light was seen in the sky which looked like the sun. It was visible within a radius of more than 20 miles, clearly defined, hence not something seen through a fog or mist, whirled in the sky like a wheel of fire, threw off shafts of coloured light which coloured objects on the ground. After several minutes, it seemed suddenly to lose itself from the sky and to plummet towards the earth, causing the crowd to believe that the world was about to end. It was over in 12 minutes.
3 months in advance, three children had predicted that a miracle would take place on that spot, at that particular time, so that everyone would believe.
The story of Fatima rarely begins in the spring of 1916, when an angel appeared to three children herding sheep in the Portuguese mountains. Describing himself as the angel of peace and guardian of Portugal, he appeared a second time and urged the children to prayer and sacrifice.
On the third and last occasion, he was bearing a chalice and host, with which he communicated the children.
The children said nothing to anyone about the apparitions. Then, on May the 13th, 1917, they were playing on the hill known as Cova da Iria, building a little wall around a thicket, when suddenly there was a flash of lightning.
Lucy, the eldest, expecting a storm, told her cousins Jacinta and Francesco to make for home.
As the children began to go downhill, driving the sheep towards the road, there was another flash, and just ahead of them, above a holm oak, they saw a lady dressed all in white.
When asked who she was, the lady simply said she was from heaven, and asked the children to return to the same spot on the 13th of every month until October, when she would reveal who she was and perform a public miracle so that everyone may believe.
Lucy warned the younger children to say nothing of the vision, but little Jacinta couldn't keep the secret, and the following month there was already a large crowd. In June, there were 5,000. It was on this occasion that the lady gave the children a secret. And when it came to August the 13th, the civic authorities took matters into their own hands. Threatening the children with death by boiling oil, they did their utmost to wrest the secret from them, or to make them admit that the whole story was a hoax.
The children refused and were released. A few days later, the lady appeared to them in the midst of a crowd of 30,000. But the opposition didn't give up.
As the day of the predicted miracle approached, the authorities acted. The government discouraged travel to Fatima, and soldiers with pointed bayonets were placed around the top of the mountain. But on the appointed day, the people came. 100,000 of them, with donkeys, cars and carts, but mostly on foot, climbing the bleak mountain 90 miles beyond Lisbon, 30,000 feet up in the Sierra Aire Mountains.
That day it was pouring with rain. But when the children arrived, Lucy asked the people to put down their umbrellas and say the rosary. In due time, the lady appeared in her usual place. She told them she was Our Lady of the Rosary and asked that they build a chapel and continue to say the rosary every day.
As the lady opened her hands, recounts Lucy, she made the light emerging from them ascend to where the sun ought to be. As she disappeared, the children looking upwards saw three more visions. St. Joseph holding the child Jesus and blessing the world with Our Lady beside him, and then Our Lord and Our Lady of Sorrows, and finally Our Lady of Mount Carmel.
It was then that Lucy shouted to the people to look at the sun. Later, the Bishop of Fatima wrote in his pastoral letter on the miracle.
Thousands upon thousands of persons saw all the manifestations of the sun, a phenomenon which no astronomical observatory registered and thus was not natural. Persons of every category and social class, believers and unbelievers, journalists of the principal Portuguese newspapers, and even persons some miles away.
Two of Portugal's leading newspapers at that time were the Daily News and the Century. Both were predominantly anti-religious, and both reported the miracle. Later, these papers returned to their attacks on religion and specifically on the events of Fatima.
But in their editions from October 13th through October 17th, both newspapers recorded eyewitness accounts of editors and reporters who were at Fatima. They'd been expecting to report a crowd dispersed by soldiers, or a crowd repudiating the children because their predicted miracle had not materialized. The accounts that follow show how dramatically mistaken they were. Here, word for word, is what the journalists saw and what appeared in print as they wrote it, word for word.
The rains kept falling. Drops trickled down the women's skirts of coarse wool or striped cotton, making them as heavy as lead. Water dripped from the caps and broad-brimmed hats onto Sunday finery. Bare feet of women and hobnailed boots of men sloshed in the wide pools of muddy roads. They didn't seem to notice the rain, but went up hills without stopping, illuminated by faith, anxious for sight of the miracle promised by the lady to take place at noon. A murmur drifting down the hills reached us. It was a murmur like the faraway voice of the sea. It was the religious songs, now becoming clear, intoned by thousands of voices. On the plateau over a hill filling the valley, there was a vast and moving mass of thousands upon thousands of people in prayer.
As they entered Fatima, some of the reporters were laughing among themselves, but around them the devout pilgrims flowed, unaware of any who were not part of the pilgrimage.
All night long, through the dark and rain, the most varied vehicles moved into the town square, carrying the faithful and the curious, and also old ladies somberly dressed and weighted by the years. At dawn, the sun was rising greyly through the rain, but dark clouds loomed over Fatima. Yet nothing could stop the crowd converging from every road toward that now holy place. Though some came in luxurious automobiles, continually sounding their horns, ox carts dragged slowly alongside them. There were carriages of all types, Victoria chaises, landaus, and wagons fitted out for the occasion with seats and crowded to the limit.
About 10 o'clock in the morning, the skies were altogether black, and sheets of rain, driven by a chilly northeast wind, whipped the faces of the pilgrims, drenched the roads, and chilled the people to the bone. Some sought shelter under the trees, against the walls, or in scattered houses. Parked along the road near Fatima were carriages of every type, and thousands of pilgrims that had come from many miles around and from the provinces gathered about the small oak tree, which, in the words of the children, their lady had chosen as a pedestal. This small, shredded tree was the center of a great circle around which the devout and other spectators ranged themselves.
At 1 o'clock, the rain stopped. The sky had a certain grey clarity, but seemed suddenly to be getting darker. The sun seemed veiled in gauze. We could look at it without strain. The grey tint of mother of pearl began changing as if into a silver disc that was growing and growing, until it broke the clouds. Then the silvery sun, still shrouded in that greyish light, began to rotate and wander within the circle of the receded clouds. The people cried out with one voice. Thousands, transported by ecstasy, fell to their knees upon the muddy ground. Then, as if it were shining through the stained-glass windows of a great cathedral, the light became a rare blue, spreading its rays upon the nave. Slowly the blue faded away, and now the light seemed to be filtered through yellow. Yellow spots were falling now upon the white kerchiefs and dark shirts of coarse wool. There were spots which repeated themselves indefinitely over the landscape. All the people were weeping and praying bareheaded, weighted down by the greatness of the miracle. These were seconds, moments, that seemed hours.
From beside the parked carriages and where many thousands stood, afraid to descend into the muddy soil of the Cova de Iria, we saw the immense crowd turn toward the sun at its highest, free of all clouds. The sun seemed to us like a plate of dull silver. It could be seen without the least effort. It didn't blind or burn. It seemed as though an eclipse were taking place. All of a sudden, a tremendous shout burst forth. Miracle! Miracle! Before the astonished eyes of the people, whose attitude carried us back to biblical times, and who, white with terror, heads uncovered, gazed at the sun, which trembled and made brusque and unheard of movement beyond all cosmic laws. The sun seemed literally to dance in the sky. Immediately afterward, the people asked each other if they saw anything, and what they had seen. The greatest number avowed that they saw the sun trembling and dancing. Others declared they saw the smiling face of the Blessed Virgin herself. They swore that the sun turned around on itself, as if it were a wheel of fireworks, and had fallen almost to the point of burning the earth with its rays. Some said they saw it change colours successively.
These were the newspaper men.
And what about the ordinary people present on that extraordinary occasion?
One of them was a schoolboy who later became Father Joachim Lorenz, a canon lawyer of the Diocese of Leiria. He tells what he saw at a distance of 9 miles.
I feel incapable of describing what I saw. I looked fixedly at the sun, which seemed pale and didn't hurt my eyes. Looking like a ball of snow revolving on itself, it suddenly seemed to come down in a zigzag, menacing the earth. Terrified, I ran and hid myself among the people, who were weeping and expecting the end of the world at any moment. It was a crowd which had gathered outside our local village school, and we had all left classes and run into the streets because of the cries and surprised shouts of men and women who were in the street in front of the school when the miracle began. There was an unbeliever there who had spent the morning mocking the simpletons who had gone off to Fatima just to see an ordinary girl. He now seemed paralyzed, his eyes fixed on the sun. He began to tremble from head to foot, and lifting up his arms, fell on his knees in the mud, crying out to God. But meanwhile, the people continued to cry out and to weep, asking God to pardon their sins. We all ran to the two chapels in the village, which were soon filled to overflowing. During those long moments of the solar prodigy, objects around us turned all colors of the rainbow. When the people realized that the danger was over, there was an explosion of joy.
Mr. Dominic Race was close to the tree where the children were and saw the event from beginning to end. He was able to look at the sun without difficulty and afterwards told of the last moments.
As soon as the sun went back in the right place, the wind started to blow real hard, but the trees didn't move at all. The wind blew and in a few minutes the ground was dry. Even our clothes had dried and looked as though they'd just come from the laundry. I believed. I thought, either I'm out of my mind or this was a miracle, a real miracle.
Almost 5 years after the miracle of the sun, the first bishop of Fatima nominated a commission to study the events which had taken place there. The bishop's statement read as follows.
If the events which took place in Fatima are true, and if they are claimed as supernatural, let us thank our Lord who vouchsafed to increase our faith and to correct our habits. If they are false, it is fitting that the falsity be discovered.
On April the 14th, 1930, the investigations were completed. And on October the 13th of that year, just 13 years after the miracle of the sun, the long-awaited decision of the Church was given.
It declared the visions of the children at Fatima worthy of belief and officially sanctioned religious devotion at the place where the miracle of the sun occurred.
You were listening there to The Miracle of the Sun, relating to the Fatima story, written and presented by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett. You also heard the voice of David Gibson. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Laudetur Jesus Christus.